Hello! Welcome to Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios with Emily Peck of Axios.
Hey, Felix.
I'm here with Elizabeth Spires, who writes the New York Times and is amazing.
Hello.
And we are going to talk about the FTC, run by Lina Khan, who has come out with a sweeping ban nationwide on non-compete clauses. We are going to talk about restaurant reservations and whether we should start having to pay for them. We are going to talk about the Biden administration's crackdown on airline fees and forcing airlines to give refunds. It's a good one. It's coming up on Slate Money. Emily, we had massive news this week. What is it?
So this week, after more than a year of saying it would do this, the Federal Trade Commission announced a rule banning non-compete agreements in employment contracts. Those are the agreements that you have to sign, or some people have to sign, 30 million estimated workers have signed, that say, if you leave your job at your current employer, you can't go work for a competitor for a certain amount of time, or you can't go work for a competitor within a 50-mile radius. They used to be used mostly for executives, but in more recent years, employers have really gotten into non-competes, using them famously for the sandwich maker Jimmy John's, use them. A lot of doctors are subject to non-competes, and nurses and other kinds of healthcare workers. And, you know, as the years have gone by, people have really started to complain about them. And the FTC is saying, you know, they make it harder for, you know, workers to take new jobs, to get raises. They blunt competition between firms for workers, and that helps keep wages low. So yeah, this week they put out this rule banning them. It's supposed to take effect in 120 days, which would be in about August. And at that time, if you have signed one of these agreements, it would be voided. Unless you are a senior executive making more than, I think it's $151,000 a year, then you still have to abide by your non-compete. But going forward, even those executives can't be subject to them anymore under this rule.
And the senior executives who are still bound, do they need to be executives, or do they just need to be paid more than $150,000 a year?
Really good question. Yeah, they not only do they need to be paid more than $151,000, they also need to have policy-making responsibilities at the company they work at.
So if I'm like a hedge fund trader or a bank trader or something like that, banks famously have this thing called gardening leave, where you can't start a new job for a certain amount of time. That all basically goes away if those people weren't actual executives, which most of the time they're not.
Yeah, according to this rule, although there's a whole separate conversation in the finance industry about whether or not this rule applies to them because of other rules and regulations in the finance industry.
It's wild to me that like doctors have this. You would think that like in the healthcare industry and among doctors, at least normally they pretend that they're not competing with each other. But they're like, oh, you can't compete.
Yeah, it's really wild. I mean, I have spoken to some doctors and they're basically stuck a lot of times because in a lot of places in the country, it's maybe one or two, you know, big companies that own the hospitals in an area. And these doctors really get stuck. Some of them wind up moving because the non-competes will restrict you to, you know, you can't work for a competitor within 50 miles or something of here. So a lot of people wind up moving for new jobs.
The doctor use case really exposes the extent to which non-competes have really just been used to lock workers into jobs. You know, in theory, they exist to keep people from walking off with trade secrets, but that just doesn't apply to doctors, I don't think.
Yeah, you don't want doctors to have any secrets.
So the counter argument to all of this is that the sort of free market conservatives like to argue that the non-competes are somehow good for workers in a roundabout way because they, you know, incentivize companies to invest more in training and educating workers, which is not an argument I buy at all. There was a conservative commentator in Forbes who wrote a whole column about why non-competes are good for workers and also good for corporations, obviously, but he made an argument partly around this idea of training and suggested that people who were trained by a company and then left were free riding on, you know, the company's, I guess, the sort of educational services that they were providing, which completely contradicts my understanding of what free riding means, because there's, in theory, the company is getting a higher quality of work, a more sophisticated quality of work, ostensibly without paying more for the labor.
Right. Companies can also keep those well-trained employees by offering them more money, you know, to stay with them. It just will cost a lot more. And I think that's why employers don't like this change, because it will cost them more to retain workers. That's sort of the bottom line.
The more rational defense is that companies don't want workers running off with trade secrets to competitors. But I'm not even sure that holds up, because running off with a trade secret to a competitor is still a problem even in the absence of non-competes, and there's still recourse for it, non-compete or no.
Right. It's still illegal to run off with the trade secrets. That's why trade secrets and IP law exists. And you can also have employees sign non-disclosure agreements if there are particular things, you know, you want them to keep quiet about. You can also incentivize people to stay with different kinds of compensation plans and benefits. That could also work. There definitely are workarounds.
The obvious thing to note here is that California has made non-competes unenforceable for ever now, and it's basically the most economically vibrant state in the union. So, like, we've tried it, we've seen it in California. It seems to be fine. There doesn't seem to be any problem in California with banning non-competes. So, in principle, it should be fine. Although in practice, Emily, there's going to be a whole bunch of legal challenge to this.
Oh, yeah. So the day after, so the FTC announced the finalized rule Tuesday. On Wednesday, the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable filed a lawsuit against the FTC in court in Texas, of course, before this judge who has already like batted down some other Biden regulations and such. And they are trying to keep this rule from ever taking effect. And I mean, I think they have a shot. The judge, like I said, who they're up against, has already batted down some other Biden stuff. The eviction moratorium comes to mind, CFPB rule in another case. And even like some former FTC people that I've spoken to say that this was like a really big swing from the agency. And yeah, it's not really clear it's going to hold up in court. There's this thing now called the major questions doctrine, which says like if there's like a major question that a regulation involves, then Congress has to be explicit and has to be the one making the new rule, and that a regulator can't do it if it's like a really big thing, like the student loan relief that Biden tried to pass that the Supreme Court knocked down. So the term major questions is in the chamber's lawsuit and in a lot of like the quotes about this. And yeah, I don't know if it's going to make it through these court challenges.
Yeah, it's a very major question. It's a very fuzzy legal concept, though. And there's a lot of gray area and, you know, the political impetus behind it, agencies of power and the executive of power. I don't know how it really holds up in practice, though. I mean, there's not a lot of, I think, direct precedent for something like this, you know, being reversed on a major questions basis.
Well, I mean, the major questions doctrine is relatively new, but the principle that legislation should come from the legislature and not from the executive branch is, I think, relatively intuitive, right? Mm-hmm. It's relatively intuitive. And in places like California, when California wants to ban non-competes, it passes legislation to that effect. If you want to ban evictions, you can ban evictions, but you want a law to that effect. Getting the Centers for Disease Control to do it is a little bit weird. And I think what we're seeing is a bunch of these things coming from the executive branch because the legislative branch is so completely otios and they can't pass anything. I think this Congress has passed fewer laws than any Congress since, you know, the 18th century or something. And that's, I think, a big problem, you know, that we do have a Congress that seems to be incapable of passing anything. And that is placing more and more onus on the executive branch to do stuff. And in an ideal world, we would see a much more active legislature debating laws and passing laws. And I do feel like this solution is the second best solution. I would personally prefer to see this coming from Congress as well.
Yeah, all that said, the Federal Trade Commission is supposed to regulate competition. And when there's unfair competition, it's supposed to combat it. And literally, this thing is called a non-compete, non-competition clause. Like, it couldn't be more squarely in the purview of the FTC, right? But yeah, the chamber and the business roundtable are like, this is too broad. This should be lawmaking. But I mean, regulators have long taken, you know, whatever their agenda or mission is and created rules around their agenda or mission. It's actually not like outside the bounds. I think it's just in this new environment, this new very conservative environment where there's a lot of, you know, moaning about regulatory overreach that we're now like, maybe it is a regulatory overreach.
Also, Lina Khan has really used the limits of the agency, you know, to great effect. I think historically, the FTC has not been this aggressive or, you know, in some ways this powerful.
Yeah. It's been, I think, 50 years since they've set any kind of like nationwide rule in this proactive way rather than just, you know, going after individual deals as anti-competitive. They have taken action against companies for abuse of non-compete clauses in the past, but nothing this broad, obviously.
So this is very much Lina Khan flexing her muscles.
Yeah. Oh yeah, this is. And I was just doing some reporting maybe for a story next week, looking at, you know, how the FTC and the Department of Justice both, and we've talked about this before as part of, you know, Lina Khan and hipster antitrust, they're looking at when mergers happen or anything happens. They're not just looking for what are the harms to consumers, but how does this lack of competition harm other kinds of classes of people and things? Like, how does it harm specifically workers, right? Because non-competes, you could argue that they harm consumers, but they definitely harm workers. Or like we talked about the Penguin House, Simon & Schuster deal that the FTC sued to stop. And the argument there was that it harmed authors. It's also trying to stop Kroger and Albertsons, the grocery stores, from merging. And that there's an argument there also that this would harm workers because there'd be fewer employers, you know, to try not hire them. So they won't have to compete as much on wages anymore.
Isn't this an argument that applies to literally every merger? Like, how does this not apply to every single merger? In the sense that every single merger reduces the number of employers who are competing for workers, and therefore it's bad for workers.
That's a good question. And one thing, I don't know how to answer it, but I can tell you that unions, which we think of as, you know, organizations that have workers' interests, you know, forefront, right? They don't always oppose mergers. They sometimes support mergers because they think if their employer is bigger and on more solid financial footing, then they're better off. So there are people who think that mergers are good for workers, actually.
Or can be. Yeah, as an employee of Axios, I can say I am happy that we were acquired by Cox, and Cox has lots of money, and I feel like that places Axios on a stronger financial footing, and it's probably good for us as employees.
Yeah. Or, I mean, there was the JetBlue-Spirit merger that did not happen. And I think the Spirit employees wanted the merger to happen because they were like, if it doesn't, we will lose our jobs. So it's good for us.
Just to go back to the non-compete issue, though, you know, the FTC does have a good business case for eliminating non-competes. And they've tried to quantify it by noting that elimination of non-competes would increase new business formation. And I don't know if, you know, that would happen in such a explosive way that it would satisfy the conservative opponents of abolishing non-competes. But it is, you know, a good other side of the coin, where not everything about abolishing non-competes is just about, you know, preserving what's good for workers. It's also good for, you know, more competition in the economy in general.
Another argument against the broad ban is that it's too broad. Like, I've seen some people say, even one of the FTC commissioners who voted against was like, I'm all for like restricting the use of non-competes, but this goes too far. Like, there are some cases where we need them. This doesn't give us any flexibility, like for, you know, higher paid employees and things like that. What do you say to that?
I think that there are other ways to thread that needle. I mean, what are the concerns there? If it's, you know, people leaking trade secrets, that can be enforced by things that are not non-competes. Right. What would be the argument for non-competes as opposed to narrower instruments?
I don't know.
I feel like non-competes, they're not that common globally. And it's entirely possible to have a vibrant capitalist economy without them. So, you know, I'm not super worried. I do understand that, like, it's natural to me that the Chamber of Commerce and people like that will oppose it because it's a way that they keep wages down. But I think that's really, like, ultimately the fight here is that employers like it because it's downward pressure on wages, and the FTC doesn't like them because it's downward pressure on wages.
Yeah. Yeah. Betsy Stevenson had a good column in Bloomberg, and she's basically like, the reason companies want non-competes is that they give them more bargaining power, and without them, they have less bargaining power. So before we get to the break, I want to tell you about Slate Plus today. Our Slate Plus segment is really good. We're talking about the TikTok ban that looks like it's actually happening, that Biden signed into law this week. So if you're a Slate Plus member, you'll get to hear that at the end of the show. If you're not a Slate Plus member and you want to hear that, you should sign up. Also, you won't have to hear ads, and you'll have access to a lot of other great Plus stuff, like unlimited access to all Slate.com content, members-only newsletter. And did I also already mention the ad-free part on the podcast? That's truly amazing. Unless you like my ad reads, then by all means, don't sign up. But I think you should. So sign up at slate.com/moneyplus. That's slate.com/moneyplus. When it comes to your finances, go for the credit card that's always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We're talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode of Slate Money is brought to you by Wondery, which is a podcast company, and it makes a podcast called The Best One Yet. And it is a daily podcast hosted by Nick and Jack, who serve up three of the most interesting business news stories every day and why you need to know them in just 20 minutes. Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that saved Abercrombie, or which real tech acquisition is like Game of Thrones, or the one financial equation that can finally solve climate change? That's the kind of stuff you find on The Best One Yet. So be in the know this year by starting your morning with The Best One Yet every weekday. Follow The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more. Wondery means business. Guys, enough policy wonkery. I want to talk about restaurants.
Yay.
I want to talk about this wonderful New Yorker article about the secondary market in restaurant reservations. And specifically, I want to talk about one number, which I was going to have in the numbers round, and then I was like, no, we have to make an entire segment about this, which is $1,050, which is the amount that a restaurant reservation at Carbone in Greenwich Village in New York traded hands for recently. And this is quite normal. This happens all the time. And just to be clear, this is just the reservation. This is just so that you can get in and sit down at the table. Then, once you're there, you then pay however many $100 for your meal.
And Felix, tell people what Carbone serves. It's not like some exotic cuisine. It's like lasagna?
It's a high-end red sauce restaurant.
Unbelievable.
It's an Italian restaurant serving good Italian food.
I think we have to explain here for people who don't live in New York that Carbone is also a very sceney place. They have turned away Justin Bieber and Hailey Bieber because they didn't have a reservation. And it's a place where I think of it as sort of junior investment banker land, where people with a lot of money and a late night social life like to go. And it's really the food is good, but it's not about the food, really.
It adds to the ridiculousness.
The first thing we need to do is really underscore, especially in the case of Carbone, I think other ones, I'm not sure, certainly in the case of Carbone, it's not about the food. It's not about the food at Rao's, where, you know, is another place that's famously impossible to get into. Like, I'm sure the food is good, but that is not the reason you go there. There are plenty of incredibly good Italian restaurants in New York where you can go, you can get a reservation, day of, no problem, have a delicious meal, probably spend a lot of money, but at least you don't need to worry about, can I get a table? And this is the fundamental reason why I think ultimately this whole secondary market and this whole Meshuggahs is good. I think that if there's a whole scene around a place like Carbone, fine. Like, let the people who want to be in the scene buy and sell their reservations and play a game like that. And then the people who have no interest in that scene and just want to have a decent meal, they can still get a decent meal at any number of places without any problem. And this is a great way of separating the two. And then the people who really care about being part of the scene are the ones who become part of the scene. And it works. Like, I think it's all good.
I don't know. I think it's kind of not great. Because should we explain how it kind of works? Basically, there are these reservation sites, sites that are, quote, democratic, like OpenTable and Resy. And you can go there and get reservations. But what happens is people basically like hack those sites. So as soon as reservations become available for a restaurant, a trendy restaurant like Carbone, they swoop in and book all the tables and then sell them on the secondary market for, like what Felix said, for like $1,000, hundreds of dollars. That just seems like, is that a good market? Is that a productive market?
I think you've got a little bit of a discomfort with it because it's kind of like scalping, you know? And,
yes.
And we think of like ticket scalping as being unethical. And
it's exactly what's happened in the concert ticket space, right? Or what's happened there for years and years.
Right. So, Emily, the answer to your question is like, yeah, no, this is a really suboptimal way of doing things. There are much better ways of doing this. And the first is by using the price mechanism, which is it is undeniable that a reservation for two people at 8 p.m. on a Saturday is a more valuable thing than a reservation for two people at 5 p.m. on a Monday, right? And yet, both are priced at exactly the same price on Resy or OpenTable, which is zero. So what we should do, and I know that Resy tried to do this when it launched, and then there was a bunch of sort of blowback, and they wound up not doing it after a while. But like, what we should do for restaurants which are regularly selling out their reservations and have no problem filling up is just embrace reality and say, look, the reservations at hot times you have to pay for. Like, there's no shame in that.
Yeah. And then the money would at least go to the restaurants who presumably are operating at pretty thin margins, right? I mean, instead of going to these scalpers in this whole roundabout widgety-wadgety system.
There was one restaurateur who argued that it helped them turn over tables faster. Their argument was that it cut down on time between turning tables because people were willing to pay, you know, more for reservations and they were less likely to bail on them or something like that.
Well, no. Wait, Elizabeth, you're saying that yes, we should be selling reservations. Restaurants should be selling.
No, I'm just saying there's it's not totally disadvantageous to the restaurants for this to happen.
Even if they're not getting the money for the reservations, they're still benefiting because they're faster turnover on the tables.
No, I think that's wrong. I think that if the restaurant is selling the reservations directly, then that's absolutely right. You know, it cuts down on no shows and stuff. If the restaurant reservations are being sniped up and then sold on the secondary market, that's bad because if they don't sell on the secondary market, then that is a reservation that is made and no one turns up, and that's bad for that's really bad for the restaurant. You want to make sure that the reservation gets used, and if people are making free reservations and expire because
I get your argument. I think the article at least was really focusing on places like Carbone where the demand is so enormous that scenario of people, you know, making a reservation not showing up, it's more that's kind of thing that happens at a normal restaurant that doesn't have that kind of demand, and then it happens just by people who are making reservations over OpenTable or whatever.
Broadly in alignment here that selling reservations is a good thing, because if you have paid for your reservation, then you are more likely to turn up. And so then the only question becomes, who should be selling the reservations? And the obvious answer to Emily's point is the restaurant. They need the revenue. It's a great new revenue source for them. So any restaurant that finds itself booking out at certain times of day on certain days of the week, yeah, charge for the reservation. Go for it, people.
And the other downside of the restaurant not making reservations anymore because they're getting hijacked by these third parties is that, and I don't know if this holds up for a restaurant like Carbone, but the author of the New Yorker piece was pointing out, like, back in the day when you used to have to call a restaurant to get a reservation and restaurants had regulars that did this, they'd keep like a little file about their regulars, you know, and they'd be like, they like this wine, or they order a lot of this thing or whatever, and they kind of like cater to them, you know? So, but if you're selling reservations under like dummy names to random people, all that kind of service is sort of out the window.
Exactly. A high-end restaurant really wants to know who's coming to dinner so that they can prepare for that person. And you can't do that if those people are buying on the secondary market, but if they buy the reservation on the primary market, it's fine. And the other way to do it, by the way, you don't need to sell the reservation directly. The other way you can do it is what Tock does, which is you sell tickets, basically, and you pay for the meal in advance, and a meal at 8 o'clock on a Saturday is going to cost more than the same meal at 5 o'clock on a Monday. And that also works. You just need to know who's coming and they need to pay.
I was going to say, what about the Wendy's methodology, you know, where you do surge pricing for the meals? Like, why don't we see more of that? I mean, I guess we see that with like happy hours and
That's exactly it. It's surge pricing. And people hate surge pricing, but that's exactly what it is.
One of the more fascinating things about this piece to me was this sort of vein of entrepreneurship of people who were just sort of in their spare time snapping up these reservations and then reselling them.
Yes.
There's a guy who is, and I refuse to believe that this is not a totally made up name because it sounds just a little too New York-y, Nicky DiMaggio, who otherwise in his day job owns a waste management company with like 40 garbage trucks. And he apparently just makes tons of money now getting reservations for, you know, D-list celebrities and rich people.
So it actually encourages new business formation, as the kids say.
But yeah, support your local restaurants, folks. And if there's a restaurant that's constantly booked out by a bunch of overpaid 27-year-olds, just support somewhere else that serves better food and that needs your custom more.
Don't pay $1,000 just for the privilege of eating lasagna. That is just bananas. Do you know how cheap it is to make lasagna?
Which is called the Olive Garden. It's a new Italian restaurant, and it is so popular that they have had 45-minute waits at lunch and dinner.
Are you selling a little? A lot? Shopify helps you sell basically anything. It is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from launching your online shop to opening up a real life store to, oh my God, I just hit 1 million orders. Shopify is there every step of the way. It will help you grow. Doesn't matter whether you're selling scented soap or outdoor outfits. They help you sell everywhere. Name the country you want to sell, they will help you sell in it. They are Canadian themselves. They understand this is a whole big world. It's not just America, people. Sell your stuff from an all-in-one e-commerce platform that even has an in-person point-of-sale system. Wherever, whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. They even now have this thing called Shopify Magic, which is an AI-powered all-star, which will help you sell even more with less effort. And they have award-winning help to support your success every step of the way. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/money, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/money now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/money. This episode of Slate Money is brought to you by Wondery, which is a podcast company, and it makes a podcast called The Best One Yet. And it is a daily podcast hosted by Nick and Jack, who serve up three of the most interesting business news stories every day and why you need to know them in just 20 minutes. Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that saved Abercrombie, or which real tech acquisition is like Game of Thrones, or the one financial equation that can finally solve climate change? That's the kind of stuff you find on The Best One Yet. So be in the know this year by starting your morning with The Best One Yet every weekday. Follow The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more. Wondery means business.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
Let's talk about airlines. We now have a new rule, not from the FTC, but from the Department of Transport, saying basically that, well, what does it do? Elizabeth, bring me up to speed.
So it basically ensures that airlines have to give cash rebates or cash refunds for flights that are delayed over 3 hours if they're domestic, over 6 hours if they're international, and for cancellations. And they also have to disclose things like change fees up front. And, you know, this feels like a very smart policy move, because if you think about something that's maybe bipartisan and universally popular, it's not having to deal with hidden fees from companies. So, and airlines are not, you know, generally not people's favorite kind of customer facing business to begin with. So yeah, this is broadly popular with everyone except the airlines.
And the thing that I like about it is the refunds have to come automatically. You don't need to ask for it. And that's even better than the European law. The European rules are relatively strict about you have to give refunds if this happens and if that happens. But the customers still have to know about that and ask the airline for the refund. In this case, the refund just has to automatically appear on your credit card, you know, whether you ask for it or not. And I really like that, because it's you basically lose the ignorance tax for people who don't know about the rule.
Yeah, it seems like a real no-brainer. The only thing I would say to Elizabeth's point about it's good politics is that it's the kind of thing that people won't even really notice or credit to the administration, because it's kind of small ball, right?
Yeah, this is why, I mean, Democrats should like just run a whole ad on it, but they won't. There's a lot of assumption that when the administration does stuff like this, that people just know. And I think it's something that people will kind of notice in the background, but not really think too hard about, you know, why it's happening or who gets credit for it or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. So is this one also going to face legal challenge in Texas?
Probably.
Really?
I mean, a lot of the Republican strategy right now is just obstructing everything that Democrats do that might be popular. I don't think that there's a lot of political capital for people to obstruct it in order to, you know, publicly demonstrate that they are, but, you know, there is a strategic reason to do it.
It's harder to confuse people about this. Like, there is a rule, a new rule from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that would limit credit card late fees, limit them to $8 from what they are now, which is like around $31. And the financial industry is fighting it like tooth and nail. And they did file suit in Texas, I believe, on that. And they're trying to argue that it's worse for consumers somehow to have the lower late fees. And I feel like just the way these financial regulation battles work is that they will convince some people that it is somehow better to have higher late fees. But on the airline junk fees, I think because people are so familiar with just the whole rigmarole of fees and flying, that it would be harder to sort of confuse the issue, right?
I think also people are so frustrated with customer service, with airlines and telecoms and so on, just not having to call anyone when these things happen, I think, is a big relief for a lot of people.
But it's going to cause inflation.
Yes.
Right? Like, the whole point is that we're going to be more likely to be bundling the fees into the price of the ticket, since it's all so as official airline price inflation does not include fees and only includes the price, then suddenly it's going to look like airline tickets cost more. And yeah, insofar as airlines have to start paying significant cash refunds to thousands of passengers who are delayed that they never used to pay anymore, that too is going to increase their costs, and that is probably going to increase ticket prices. So I think it is intuitive to me that this rule will make it more expensive to fly. It'll just be more transparent and less annoying.
Well, and in theory, it'll also make it more reliable to fly, because that heavily incentivizes the airlines to really fix their delay and cancellation problems.
Yeah, I'm not sure I buy that one. Like, airlines have a massive cost to delays anyway, even without refunds. That they always, you know, if an airline has a flight that is 5 hours delayed, that winds up costing them a huge amount of money in like labor and in the planes being in the wrong place for them. And the efficient airlines try to save money by not doing that. And yeah, at the margin, this will make it even more expensive, and so they'll have even more of an incentive not to do it. But yeah, like, delays happen, and yeah, they just wind up getting built into the price now, because they are going to be even more expensive for the airlines.
So would you guys rather see ticket prices just go up and fees go away?
Yeah.
We've had this discussion on the pod when we were talking about Danny Meyer and his move to all-inclusive pricing in restaurants. And it seemed like a great idea. And then everyone complained about it, and he rolled it back and he said, oh, never mind. In principle, like, that's not good. You want to be able to know how much something costs before you pay for it. But but we live in a country where the convention, very much in almost everything, is that everything winds up, not everything, airlines don't generally, but most things in like stores show a pre-tax price, and then the price you actually pay is more than the price that is on the sticker. And that whole sort of weird bait and switch is so internalized in the American psyche that I think I like to think that it's cheaper than it actually is, because then it feels cheaper or something.
I also think people are pretty infuriated when they look at their, you know, cable or cell phone bill and see fees tacked on, or like $20 for something that is inexplicable. And I do think they sort of do think about, you know, the cost of these things, even if they're not explicated in the total price.
The Biden administration is also going after the resort fees. I don't know if they've passed any rules around that yet, but I know that last year there was talk of not only restricting the airline junk fees, but also the hotel junk fees. The hotels pushed back and they said resort fees are meaningful.
Yeah, the resort fees at hotels, people really hate those. So I do think there's a distinction to be made between fees, taxes, and tips. And the Biden administration seems to be going after the fees and not like the taxes and the tips. But in my mind, they're all similar. But convention is, yeah, we will pay the tip separately, we'll pay the tax separately, but just don't do fees.
Right,
fees
but if bad. What you were saying earlier, that like we say we don't like fees, but we also don't like when the prices are higher and kind of prefer to live in this like illusion fantasy world where we think the prices are lower, so that when the fees get tacked on, it's like a whole different mental thing. That sounds a lot like the girl math that was like a thing a few months ago, right? Where like, you know, you say like, oh, I just returned these pants that I didn't want. Now I have an extra $100. It's like a bonus, you know, stuff like that. Girl math, it was called. It kind of feels like the whole economy runs on girl math when you think about it.
It really does. I was just looking for a hotel room in San Francisco on a website which does a pretty good job of showing like the all-in cost, but it also shows the headline cost. And all of these hotel rooms, they're like $117. Nice. After tax and fee, it's $290. And you're like, what? It makes no sense. We should have a numbers round. Elizabeth, what's your number?
My number is 5, and that's the number of euros that it's going to cost you to visit Venice for the day now. because Venice is dealing with I think somebody referred to it as over touristing. There are 20 million tourists in Venice last year. And there's just not, I guess, infrastructure or the capacity to deal with that kind of influx. So now they're charging a fee to visit. And I guess this is kind of like congestion pricing in Manhattan, where the idea is that maybe people will not just show up spontaneously if they know they have to pay something for it.
This is like experiences in person are just becoming more and more expensive because the demand is so high, like concert tickets, cool restaurants, going to Venice, surge pricing. I mean, Manhattan's doing it now, right? With charging cars higher fees to come into Manhattan during rush hour. Everything's surge pricing. It's crazy.
Well, yeah. And I'm in favor of this. Like, yeah, use the price mechanism to reduce the overcrowding. Venice does a relatively good job of limiting the number of hotel rooms. But yeah, a whole bunch of people just come in from out of town for the day, often on cruise ships, although they're also doing a pretty good job of reducing the number of cruise ships. And it's those people who aren't staying in the Venice hotels who are causing most of the crowding. And asking them to pay €5, and if that helps to pay for, you know, the very expensive project of keeping Venice above water and defraying some of the costs of all of the tourism, yeah, I'm all in favor.
Yeah, but if you keep using the price mechanism for everything, I feel like you're creating a world in that's really geared, I mean, it is already, but really, really geared to the higher income people. And it's just making things more unequal. You know, if we're really looking to surge price like a city or parks or, you know, where does it end, Felix?
Where does it end? Where does it end? It's a slippery slope.
Yes, a slippery slope. People are saying that. More and more people.
My number is 1.6%, which was first quarter GDP growth, which was way lower than we've been seeing in the past couple of quarters. In Q3, it was 4.9. In Q4, it was 3.4. And now it's 1.6. Like, I don't know. Maybe all of these rate hikes are finally having an effect?
Could be. Neil Irwin of Axios says, under the hood, it's not as bad as it seems.
I will trust Neil on this one. He knows much more about such things than I do. Emily, what's your number?
Okay, this might be unconventional, but my number is 1906L.
Is that a license plate?
Is that an Elon Musk kid?
All right, that's a good guess. It's the name of a New Balance shoe coming out in August that has gone viral. And that is because it looks like a penny loafer crossed with a sneaker. Jacob Gallagher in the Wall Street Journal calls it a snofer.
A snofer.
GQ calls it deceptively normal. And it is, I guess, the latest example of two trends: ugly sneakers, which are popular, and work appropriate sneakers, which is a thing I don't think we've talked about, but how it's okay now to wear sneakers to work, right? So anyways, it's kind of ugly. People can go look at it online and tell me what they think about the snofer.
How much is it? That's what I want to know.
It's unclear. It doesn't say. None of the marketing materials seem to tell me the price. So I don't know. There's a similar suede loafer from Loro Piana that costs like $1,000. But knowing New Balance, it's probably costs a lot less.
The New Balance one looks so much like a sneaker in terms of the materials. It just looks like, you know, a sneaker mated with a boat shoe and then mutated into something. I can't imagine wearing it with a really nice work outfit or suit or something like that.
It's very dad shoe is what the people are saying. But I think that's pretty insulting to dads. I don't know. Some of them dress well.
I just looked this up on the internet on a site called kicksonfire.com. And I have no idea whether they're reliable, but they reckon it's going to have a retail price of $150.
Very reasonable for a snowfur.
I mean, it's just, can you find a snowfur for less than $150? No, you can't.
I doubt it.
Okay, on that note, I think we're going to wrap it up for this week. Many thanks to Jared Downing and Shana Roth for producing. Many thanks for sending us your emails on sleepmoney@sleep.com. And we will be back on Tuesday with a Money Talks with Emily. Tell me who.
I talked to Jen Murphy. She's a longtime columnist for The Wall Street Journal who writes about people's workouts. So she has been, for 20 years, she's had this column for The Journal where she talks to executives and all kinds of people about how they fit exercise into their daily lives. And it's a really good conversation for anyone who loves to work out or wishes they love to work out. Jen is awesome and you should listen.
Graham, looking forward.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.